Hey there, welcome to another edition of the LiveWire House Party. I'm Luke Burbank. We are going to be talking about the power of words this week. First up, with legendary rapper Talib Kweli. He is the guy that Jay-Z raps about when it comes to who has the best lyrical prowess in the game. We're going to talk about Talib's new memoir. Then George Saunders is going to stop by. He has won just about every literary award there is, but I think his new book might be his most amazing accomplishment because it's about Russian literature, and yet it is not even a little bit boring. In fact, it's totally fascinating. Can't wait to talk to him. Then we're going to hear some music from Gillette Johnson about that moment when words just seem to completely fail you. The word on the street is that this is going to be a great show, and by the street, I just mean I have a hunch. But it's a strong one. So stick around. It all gets started right after this.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
This episode of LiveWire is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving or cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hey there, Elena.
Hey, Luke. How's it going?
Pretty good. How was the weather for you this week? A lot of people were snowed and iced in and losing power.
Yeah, I think I heard that like 50% of the country was at some point over the course of the week under a winter weather advisory. But in Corvallis, yeah, where I live, nothing really to say. It's been above freezing, no snow, no ice, just kind of chilling down here. How about you?
Things have definitely been icy and kind of sketchy here in Portland. A lot of people losing power, including our own Molly Pettit. Still, though, nothing like what folks in Texas have been dealing with. So we're really thinking about them this week. That being said, since we are lucky enough to have power, what do you say? Should we go ahead and do this little radio show?
Let's do it.
All right, Molly, wherever you are, are we recording?
From some random motel in the Couve. We're ready.
Checking in from a Best Western in Vancouver, Washington, where there is power.
You got it.
Take it away, Elena.
From PRX, it's LiveWire. Recorded from our actual houses. Welcome to the LiveWire House Party. This week, rapper and activist Talib Kweli and writer George Saunders, with music from Gillette Johnson. I'm your announcer, Elena Passarello, and now, the host of LiveWire, Luke Burbank!
Yay! Oh, thank you so much, Elena Passarello. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. We've got a fun show in store for you this week. Hopefully you're hearing us not on a like emergency battery-powered radio as you are hunkered down somewhere.
A hand crank radio.
Yeah. It's been quite the week, but we made it to the weekend. And of course, as we like to do each week, we ask listeners a question. We ask them, what is your favorite word or phrase? That is because we are talking a lot about words and writing. We have a couple of incredible writers on the show this week, George Saunders and Talib Kweli. We're going to get to those audience responses here in a little bit. First, though, of course, we have to do the best news we've heard all week. This is where we like to remind ourselves and the listeners that, of course, good things can also happen. Elena, what is the best news that you heard all week?
Okay, this week we got to go for some great news to Scotland, where
really okay
to Scotland, where a 33-year-old mother of three named Charlene Leslie pushed, or there's video of her appearing to push, like what looks like a semi-truck, delivery truck of milk up a hill during a snowstorm. And the dairy farm, Graham's Family Dairy, was so grateful for her help, although they did encourage all of their customers to never try to do that at home or anywhere else. But they were so grateful, they gave her a year's supply of milk for her superwoman heroism.
Were one of her kids like under the semi? I mean, that's like superhuman strength. She pushed a semi truck up a hill.
Well, I mean, speaking of moms, though, she did like such a great mom thing. Before she went to help the truck, she made sure that she got a babysitter for the kids. Like she dropped off the kids at the neighbors and then ran into the road. And then I think the truck is actually kind of moving on its own accord, but she's just kind of keeping it steady, which is probably a little dangerous, but she just looks like a badass. She looks amazing.
Wow. You know, this week in Portland, there was a ton of snow and people were getting stuck left and right. And I'm very happy to say the community spirit was on full display. Mm-hmm. People were just out. My car got stuck at one point and three random Green Bay Packers fans showed up. I knew this because they were fully decked out in Packers gear. They pushed the car out of the snowdrift. Like, even though it's been a real tough week, it's nice when everybody kind of teams up. There's just this understanding that if somebody is stuck in the snow or the ice and you can help, you sort of have to, right?
Amen.
Speaking of doing some good in the world, the best news that I saw this week involved the wardrobe of Alex Trebek, the late Jeopardy host, which is being donated to an organization called the Doe Fund that provides paid work and housing for people who are coming out of homelessness and other sort of situations. And, you know, if you are trying to get a job and maybe you haven't had access to a kind of professional looking wardrobe for a while, that can be a bit of a challenge. Mm-hmm. So a number of these guys that go through this program are going to be wearing Alex Trebek's actual suits from Jeopardy when they go apply for a job. And there is a photo of a couple of the men from this program with Alex Trebek's duds. And it is just the most heartwarming thing you will ever see. And I promise you, they are getting those jobs.
Oh, yeah.
There's something cosmic. If you show up in Alex Trebek's actual pinstripe suit, I'm giving you any job you're applying for, right?
That's some fairy dust, too. Like, even if the people don't know, they'll be able to sense the fabulousness, the professionalism. I mean, because Alex Trebek was famously very professional. He got in a car accident once and then just hitched a ride to do Jeopardy that day. He was a super pro. So if you're wearing an Alex Trebek Jeopardy suit, the sky is the limit.
Although it might be a little weird when, during the job interview, the person being interviewed keeps answering everything in the form of a question.
Yeah.
But there's just some, you know, institutional memory in those suits that just kind of stuck in there. So there you go. That is the best news that we've heard all week. All right, let's get our first guest here onto the house party. He is one of the most highly acclaimed rappers in the world. He is known for his sharp lyrics and also his activism. He's worked with, like everyone, Kanye West, Pharrell Williams. He's half of the hip-hop duo Black Star, along with Mos Def. And he's got a new memoir out. It's called Vibrate Higher, A Rap Story, which talks about his childhood growing up in Brooklyn, and his career, and what it's like to be the rapper that all of the other rappers respect, even if you're not maybe a household name, like a Jay-Z. So we're so excited to have him on. Talib Kweli, welcome to the LiveWire House Party.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate the love and the support.
I really enjoyed this book, Vibrate Higher. And right at the beginning, you have a line in the book that really kind of stopped me. You write, "The truth is most rappers are super nerds. Our need to be liked by everybody is why we use rhymes to try to explain what you are going through and ultimately bring you closer to us." Like, you start out by immediately demystifying rappers. Like, I've never felt like rappers were more relatable than when I read that line.
Well, I got to apologize to all my fellow rappers. I might have just been speaking for myself. And I said I was speaking on behalf of all the good rappers. But, you know, maybe there's some rappers that don't feel that way. But I travel in a lot of rapper circles, and the best MCs in the world are nerds. You know, they're and I guess everyone's a nerd about what they're good at. you know, but I find that rappers are nerds about a bunch of things. You know, rappers are watch Star Wars in the office and, you know, do really nerdy things and get really excited about it.
I mean, you got to get the lyrics from somewhere, right? I mean, one of the things I love about your music, Talib, is that you just reference everybody and everything in your songs.
Well, I'm a fan of pop culture. My father is a sociology professor, and I pay attention to pop culture. As I get older, my interests narrow. But, you know, as a young kid, I watched every single thing on television. You know, I would listen to every single song, every single genre of music, everything that came out. I would just consume all of it. You know, I guess my tastes are more refined now. I don't have time or brain space to be doing that anymore. I'm more focused now as an older man. But yeah, when I was younger, I just consumed, devoured everything.
Speaking of your parents, you talk in this book about being raised with the concept of Black cultural nationalism and Pan-Africanism. What does that exactly mean, and what did that look like for you as a young man growing up in Brooklyn?
It meant representation. You know, you hear that phrase now, representation matters, so often. And I was honored and blessed and privileged as a child to have Black representation in my life. And I feel like because of it, it's made me a better man. Having the name Talib Kweli, such a powerful, strong name, seeing African art on the walls, reading about African authors. It wasn't just Black History Month. It was an everyday thing. It was just part of our routine. The fact that my mother worked at a college named after Medgar Evers, and she worked alongside Betty Shabazz, and understanding that it wasn't just about Malcolm X, but it was also about Betty Shabazz, understanding it wasn't just about Medgar Evers, also about Merle Evers. I remember as a kid, my block reminded me of Sesame Street. Like Sesame Street's a national show. At this point, an international show. But that it looked like my block. And it felt like that. And the inner city doesn't come without problems. But we had problems. You know, it's roaches and rats and, you know, homelessness and a crack epidemic. And all these things were affecting my childhood. But it was a strong sense of community. And for me, Black cultural nationalism is not about at all segregation or separating from white people, but it's about gaining equity. It's about cooperative economics. It's about doing what other communities who are privileged to not be brought over here as slaves, those other communities, immigrant communities, built up by supporting each other's businesses, you know, spending dollars with each other. And the Black community has not done that in the way that other communities have had for a lot of reasons. But Black cultural nationalism sort of tries to get people in that headspace so that we could not be dependent on white people in the government, but really be dependent on ourselves.
We're talking to Talib Kweli here on the LiveWire House Party. His book is Vibrate Higher, a rap story. Were you confident when you set about to write this book that it was going to be good? Because like you're a writer, you write music, you've done experimental theater, but that's different than a memoir.
You're right. I'm very nervous about the reception of this book. I'm a very confident MC. I'm better than most rappers. And in what I do, I'm very, very confident about my skill level in hip hop. And that's part of the hip hop thing, right? That's part of the great MC thing is the being able to brag about your skills. I don't have that same confidence in the literary world. And I'm looking at my peers in this world now and the shoulders that I'm standing on. And I'm like, wow, I hope people like the book. It took me about 4 or 5 years to really complete it.
Wow.
But really, it was more like 3 years. The last two were me hemming and hawing and not turning it into the publisher because I was nervous about how it would be received. And then it's a lot of personal stuff in there, too. So it's like, should I share this? Are these people going to be upset at me? For anyone's listening, my book doesn't have the tea. It's not juicy with gossip. But it's certainly, you know, personal stuff in there. And that made me nervous.
It's so upfront, too. Like, it has, like, this amazing directness. And it's not that you're indirect in your albums and your work as a hip-hop artist, but it just has this frankness that doesn't really connote lyricism in this way that is just so wonderful. The scenes just come alive, like Brooklyn in the 80s and 90s.
Oh, wow. That's a huge compliment. I really appreciate that. And that's what you just said is what I was trying to convey, is that this book is not just about me. It's about Brooklyn in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's about the Ruckus era. It's about a certain type of hip hop. It's about all of these things. And I'm proud of the fact that in the academic space, in the literary space, I don't think we've seen some of the things that I've talked about. I don't think we've seen people talk about Dilla and Madlib and Kanye West and Yasiin Bey in this way, and even Dave Chappelle in this way. And so I'm proud to be able to bring their stories to life as well.
We got to take a real quick break, but when we come back, we're going to continue talking to Talib Kweli. His latest book is Vibrate Higher, a Rap Story. Stay with us. This is the LiveWire House Party. Welcome back to the LiveWire House Party from PRX. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. We're talking to Talib Kweli, the hip-hop artist and writer. He's got a book out, Vibrate Higher, a Rap Story. One of the things, Talib, that I've been really interested to follow in your career over the last, I don't know, 10 years is the business model that you've embraced as an artist. You have a track off of one of your mixtapes. We run this volume 7, and it's like the last track is called like Speaking About Career, where it's just you talking. I mean, actually, I think Kanye also did a version of this on Last Call, where it's just an artist talking about their experience of trying to make it in this business and then also make it work for them. What is the version of hip hop business that you've embraced so that you can keep doing this for your job?
For me, I think it's about learning when it was time for me to leave the music industry and build an industry around myself. And for me to figure out how to stop competing with other rappers and compete with myself. I had a very fierce competitive spirit, and I think it served me well in the industry. I put myself, in my mind, I would had to be better than every rapper. I had to compete with every rapper. And so I listened to every album. I knew every hit song. I paid attention to the radio. I was very focused. I knew every trend. I knew every label, every artist. And that worked for a number of years. But when I started approaching 40, I had to start focusing more on myself and making sure that I would be able to eat and I'd be able to make a living regardless of what happened in the music business. The music business collapsed around me. When I was first starting, every budget was $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 for an album or a video. Millions of dollars were spending on everything. I remember I just did Jimmy Fallon's show, and he said, "Man, when I was hanging out with you, you had the most beautiful watch I've ever seen. You had this beautiful Louis Vuitton watch." And I was like, "I didn't have no Louis Vuitton watch." And I was like, I did have a beautiful watch. I forgot about it. I was like, I was doing all this extravagant rapper stuff. You know, I was buying expensive watches and expensive sunglasses and stuff like this to go to nightclubs. And then I would lose this stuff. You know, just the amount of money and the amount of everything is like that. I have to give a props to like LP from Run the Jewels, Killer Mike, but LP in particular, because he started on Ruckus when I started on Ruckus. But while I was living this like rapper life and like getting major deals and spending all this money, he was building an independent musical empire. And so I talk about this in the book, God Bless Ryan Leslie, who is also an artist who's like that. He built a website for me, QualiClub.com. And that's when I really understood that I could do it myself. I put out the Gravitas album. It was the first album that was completely self-distributed by myself. And I did okay, just off record sales. I've always in the past had to wait for the record label to get their money first. So the idea that I just put something out and the money would come right back in my pocket immediately, that was foreign to me at the time. And and I've been moving in a more independent direction since.
One of the things you write about in this book is that, you know, Jay-Z name-checked you in a song. He said, "If skills sold truth be told, I'd probably be lyrically Talib Kweli." And how that name-check did more PR work for you than, you know, or the same amount as years of you out there grinding. How do you feel about your place in the hip-hop universe, I guess, is the real question.
I feel good that Jay-Z saying my name was validation for me. And it made me feel like if I was confused about my place in hip hop, well, then this helped out. That happened in 2004 when Jay-Z said that in Moment of Clarity. In 2004, Kanye West and 50 Cent were the biggest things in the rap game. 50 Cent, when he did an interview for XXL, he was the editor for 1 month. They asked him who he wanted to interview. He can interview anybody. They'll go get him. He wanted to interview me. Mm-hmm. Kanye West was someone who I would take in on tour. So I watched these artists who respected me so much, love what I do. I inspire these guys, and then they come out and they make way more money than me. What am I doing wrong? And then Jay-Z said that lyric. And it's like, wow, maybe if I rapped more about money, I'd have a lot more money.
You manifest it.
Right, right. Because Jay-Z definitely did that. But then what you just said is correct, right? You manifest it. Well, what is it that I rapped about all the time? I rapped about cultural nationalism. I rapped about, like I said, I want to be better than every rapper. Well, I achieved that. So it's like, I didn't have the money, but I did. I manifested exactly what, and that was a big lesson for me.
Right.
Words are power. Very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, you are really known for your lyrics, and you write in this book that you really have always tried to hold yourself to a really high lyrical standard, regardless of what the trends are. I mean, right now, a lot of the hip hop that's very popular is very lyrically spare. Mm. I mean, what's your relationship with the very popular hip hop of the moment that is much less lyric heavy than the stuff that you do?
I mean, I learn from wherever I can learn from. What I have learned from artists that are not as lyrical, whether it's a Young Thug or an Old Dirty Bastard or a young dude that passes away like Juice WRLD or, mm-hmm. Stuff like that, that's more about vibing. Old Dirty, if he was around, I got to qualify that, would be upset if I said he wasn't lyrical. What I've learned is to appreciate the musicality of letting go of the lyrics. As a lyricist, I need that. Slum Village, J Dilla's group, their first album was called Fantastic Volume 1. And J Dilla is like our godfather. And me, Mos Def, The Roots Common, Erica, we were all worshiping at the feet of Dilla and listening to Slum Village album over and over again. And on that first album, they have a song called Fantastic. And the song is like a minute long. And the lyrics are, we say fan, ta, so what? You say, huh. It's dash. So it's for y'all to dance to it slow because it's fantastic. Now that doesn't make any sense to me. but I love it. And it taught me to be more loose with my words and just be more funky and just feel the vibe. And as someone who just focused on every lyric has to be enunciated and said perfectly, it was good for me to learn that lyric. So the takeaway from that is I don't have any problem with mumble rap or non-lyrical rap. They can't do what I do at all. Mm-hmm. And so all I could do is just learn from that and listen to it and catch the vibe.
Yeah, which is very related to the title of this book, Vibrate Higher, A Rap Story. It's Talib Kweli's new book. It's amazing. Got to go out and get it. Talib, thank you so much for coming on the LiveWire House Party, man. We really appreciate you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Talib Kweli right here on the LiveWire House Party. His new memoir is Vibrate Higher, A Rap Story. Hey, special thanks this week to Jed Foster of beautiful Auburn, Washington. Jed is part of the LiveWire member community and is generously supporting our show with a donation each month, which is a really huge deal because it's how we're able to do the show. So thank you so much, Jed Foster, for keeping LiveWire going. This is the LiveWire House Party. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. As we like to do each week, we ask the LiveWire listeners a question. We ask them, what is your favorite word or phrase? Because we're talking a lot about word usage and language and writing this week on the show. What are the listeners saying? Are their favorite words or phrases, Elena?
Well, here are two. One is from M. Anna, and one is from Linda. And they're the same word.
Okay.
Serendipity.
Ooh.
So isn't it serendipitous that two of the LiveWire listeners picked the word serendipity as their favorite word or phrase?
That is a really nice word. Mm-hmm. Like it flows nicely. It's always a positive, right? When something is serendipitous, it's just like things are kind of working out. Yeah, I like that word. What's another word or phrase that the LiveWire listeners are into?
Here's one from Tracy. Tracy says, my 4-year-old's preschool teacher taught her the phrase, you get what you get and you don't get upset. And that has been my favorite parenting phrase during the pandemic.
Those are some words of wisdom right there. You get, what is it again? You get what you get.
This is a 4-year-old who's being told this. Listen up, adults. you get what you get and you don't get upset. Like, I don't know how we move away from that, but I do think that it is important sometimes to enjoy the things that you receive.
Yeah. From the mouth of babes or the mouth of the person teaching the babes. Some sage wisdom.
Yeah.
All right. What's another word or phrase that our listeners really like?
Here's a classic from Tammy. Tammy's favorite phrase, time for dinner.
I will say that there are many days during the pandemic where dinner is a highlight. Like, I'll start thinking about dinner at about 8 a.m.
Yeah.
You know?
You know what I do? Because David and I are together all day long, every day. I save words for dinner. So if I think of something to say to him, rather than yell it downstairs, I'm like, oh, that's going in the dinner bank. So I really look forward to, I don't know if he looks forward to it anymore, but
I have totally been at that point in a relationship where you're like, oh, that's going to be good.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. This will kill like 8 minutes.
This is gonna
of the dinner conversation.
Yeah.
Oh, love.
Yeah.
Exciting and new. Okay. What's another word or phrase?
Oh, yeah, this one is
that
very...
maybe some of our listeners can use at dinner with their significant others, you know, if they're just looking to fill time.
This is Alice's favorite phrase, and it comes from Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona. You, minion, are too saucy. So I guess at dinner, you could say that to your partner or you could say it to like your spaghetti. You could say either minions are too saucy.
I like that a lot. Although depending on who you're talking to, they may think you're talking about those little yellow fire hydrant looking guys, the minions.
You minions.
They've really, I would say they've probably at this point maybe replaced the Shakespearean notion in the popular consciousness.
Now I want to see Two Gentlemen of Verona done only with minions.
I would watch that during lockdown.
I would watch anything at this point.
All right, this is the Live Wire House Party. I'm Luke Burbank. That is Elena Passarello. Speaking of words, our next guest is, in my opinion, maybe the best writer of words out there at the moment. You're a close second, Elena.
Oh, okay? Thanks.
I want you to know that. But this guy's pretty amazing. His last book, Lincoln and the Bardo, won the Booker Prize. He also teaches creative writing at Syracuse University in this program that, I mean, like thousands of people apply for this every year, Elena, right? And it's like 7 people get in or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, crazy low acceptance rate. It's a very selective
school.
It's
very, very exclusive. The good news is, though, for all of us who will probably never get into this class, is his latest book kind of gives you a peek into what it would be like to be one of his students. The book is called A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, and it's taken from a class on Russian short stories that George Saunders has been teaching for years, and it is just such a great read. You know, I heard Russian literature. I don't know, is this going to be very engaging for me? And I just couldn't put this book down. So we're so excited to have him on the show. Let's welcome George Saunders to the Live Wire House Party.
It's great to be here, sort of here, virtually here.
Yeah, last time that we spoke, it was when you were on tour with Lincoln and the Bardo, which was obviously a huge hit. It was a bestseller. It won a Booker Prize. This new book of yours, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, is really... it's really different. It's you breaking down Russian short stories to kind of explore what makes a story work. When did you decide that you wanted this to be your follow-up book?
Like almost everything I do, it was just kind of ad hoc. I was teaching up at Syracuse for the first time in a year, and I was loving it, and came out of a class and was like, you know what? Someday I should kind of like pay tribute to teaching, how much I've loved it and how much it's meant to me. So it kind of, you know, got in the front of the line that way. And then somehow whenever my mind would turn to it, I'd be really happy because I kind of felt like maybe after that, all that touring and yapping, I needed a little bit of a little moment back in the woodshed just to kind of like touch base with the love of it, you know, and try to kind of reconfigure my head a little bit. So it would turn out to be kind of a 2-year, almost like a meditative pause in the writing process just to see, you know, like, did I want to keep doing this or not? Which it turns out I did, but.
How did you choose these particular stories? I mean, I guess you were teaching them, but I guess my question is, why did you decide to teach these particular Russian stories to your students and now to everybody who reads this book?
Yeah, again, in the beginning, it was just, you know, like my whole teaching career has been kind of like, I'm writing a book. We've got kids. Uh-oh, class is coming up. What should I do? You know, so in this case, it was the first time I'd really taught a big group of grad students. So I just been reading Tolstoy, and I thought, you know, I'd like to get better acquainted with these Russians. I'll just assign some of them, even stories I hadn't read before. So that was back in 97. And then over the 20 years, I've taught it maybe 8 or 9 or 10 times. And every time it's fun. It's kind of a hit. And there was about 15 stories that always teach well, you know, sometimes because they're really good, sometimes because the kids hate them. But so I started with those 15. And then it became clear that if we were going to include the stories in the book, which I thought was really important, then it had to be 7 or 8. And then it became a bit of a Rubik's Cube, just which stories presented certain lessons at the right time and place, just kind of arranging and rearranging. So there are stories that I actually like more than these that maybe are even better, but just didn't fit into the sort of teaching plan.
Was there something in the water in Russia in the 19th century that all these sort of masterpieces were being written?
I think cyanide, for sure, was definitely, you know, some iron. No, you're exactly right. There's something very amazing about these stories. And Mary Carr the other day said she thought that it was a little bit like that period in Russian literature was kind of like the late 60s were in rock and roll. Like just somehow the form was figuring out what it was, and all the talented young people gravitated toward it. It was the most fun, you know, sort of natural mode of expression, the most admired. So I think it was something like that. And maybe because the story form was so new, it just naturally molded itself to that national consciousness, which was so turbulent at that point. You know, they had a dictatorship, and they had a lot of undercurrents of revolution that were then fought back. And so I think it was just a really ripe time. For my purposes, they're so simple. The stories are kind of simple. And I think sometimes it might be that they're so far away from us now. You know, there's no modern accoutrements in it. It's just sort of a world that's long gone, which maybe helps us see the stories as aesthetic objects a little simpler. They don't have the internet. They don't have anything that we would recognize as contemporary politics to distract or confuse us. It's just kind of people in sleds, you know, with no phones. So in some ways, this maybe is sort of elemental.
This is LiveWire. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. We're talking to George Saunders. His latest book is A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. George, there were so many moments in this book where you really introduced a new way of thinking about storytelling for me, including this kind of juggling analogy, which I don't know if you invented that or if that's sort of well-known. I've just never been to grad school for writing, but can you kind of explain that to the people listening?
Yeah, at this point, I don't know what I invented and what I stole from students, but just the idea that really a story, you could think of it as, you know, the storyteller throws some bowling pins in the air, you know, or bowling balls or apples, whatever. And then, you know, the reader notices those things going up. We notice those things being put into play. And then really the whole story is just that feeling of suspense of whether or not they'll come down and whether or not the writer will catch them. So a bad story would be one where six things go into the air and only one come down. Or they all come down and he or she fumbles the catch. But there's a lot of metaphors in the book, and really none of them are true or correct. They're just supposed to be helpful. But this one's helpful to me because it sort of makes it a little more like entertainment. You know, you're just out there doing something, you're dancing, you do certain moves, the audience notices, and they wait for the recursion of that move maybe. I'm always looking for ways of thinking about writing that demystifies it and makes it less sort of intellectually foreboding, you know.
That's one of the things that I loved about this book so much is maybe not even thinking about your students at Syracuse, but the general readers of this book. It gives them so much license to just experience these things that might be kind of cordoned off. Like, I can't remember the exact name of it. Is it the things I couldn't help but noticing cart, which is like your ultimate tool when you're reading a short story? Could you tell us a little bit about that as like a way of reading and absorbing these pieces?
Sure. And again, all of this is just crap that I made up over the years that seemed to land. You know, this is not you know, rules or anything. Okay, so say, for example, you're reading a story and you notice that the character has a habit that we sometimes see in salespeople of obsessively repeating the name of the person to whom she's speaking. So she's like, Elena, you know, it's a really nice day here, Elena. I'm sure, Elena, that you've noticed. Well, okay, so now that might have gotten in there just because you were being a little sloppy. But once it's in there, it becomes a thing. It becomes a thing you couldn't help noticing if you're the reader. So the writer's job then is to capitalize on it somehow. You know, notice it, bless it, and then capitalize on it. if she chooses to leave it in there. And so my thing is that part of our satisfaction at the end of the story is that all these little, maybe hundreds of things that we notice along the way that are a little excessive, a little off, a little chosen, that somehow or another, hopefully in a complex way, they come home to land. That's really the work of art. You do something, you notice you did it, and you sort of, in a certain way, you go, yeah, I meant to do that. You didn't make it to purpose. So, yeah. And again, the only reason these ideas are fun for me is that they lessen my anxiety as a creative person. You know, those of us who want to be artists, and there's so many people who want to be artists, it's so hard and it's so mysterious and it's not really true that everybody can do it beautifully. You know, there are people who can't, and even those of us who can do it can't do it reliably. So that makes us hungry for some kind of certainty, i.e. a system of rules. And then the educational system comes in and offers to give it to us. But the hardest thing is to keep humble and arrogant at the same time to say, this is so hard that there can be no rules except the ones for me on this specific day, which are going to go away tomorrow. You know.
We're talking to George Saunders about his latest book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. This is LiveWire. People think that this book is just about maybe deconstructing or understanding, you know, Russian short stories or storytelling in general, I think you make the case that there's a certain political element to understanding how to read a story, particularly in the moment that we are living in, where information is coming at us sort of fast and furious, and it's really hard to know what to believe and not believe.
Yeah. I think, you know, you look at the information where most of us are getting, it's surface, as we used to say in geology school, surficial. It's surficial. It's got an agenda built right into it, most of it. And even when it doesn't, the corporate conduit that is coming through is shaping it for us, you know, whether by limiting our characters or kind of bringing out a certain performative streak in us. And you contrast that with these stories, which were written over a long period of time by somebody relatively disinterested, except in these big questions, and maybe more specifically interested in making their characters be realistic and human. So I think what it can do is it can show us in capsule form, first of all, the way our minds tend to work, which is that we're walking down the street, somebody's coming toward us, our mind gives us a spot judgment before we even want it. It just tells us what to think of that person based on who knows what. So in real life, we walk by, and that person is whatever we just thought she was. In literary world, we get to sort of spin on our heels and follow that person. And if the writer is good, as these are, they give us this little superpower, which is to propel us right into the head of that person. And we follow the thoughts and the little insecurities and the little itches under their armpits and so on. And before long, six pages later, we're almost indistinguishable from that person. So in other words, we've grown some empathy for them. And even if they're a kind of rotten person, we're there inside them and we're invested. So I think people can do that on their own, of course. I mean, that's what we try to do. But literature gives us a little crash course in that kind of empathy. And what happens, at least to me when I read these stories, is you're in there. You're not free of judgment. You still have your opinion. If the person does something reprehensible, you notice it. But somehow you learn that you can abide a little longer than you thought. You know, you don't have to make the spot judgment. You can, but it doesn't really do much good. You can abide there a lot longer, and your decisions, such as they have to be, get more precise. And I would say that the ability to make a more precise decision later in the show might be exactly equal to what we call compassion.
This is probably a hard question for you to answer, George, because it's trying to, I don't know, sum up something inimitable about you as a writer and as a teacher of writing. But you mentioned your background in geology and you had a whole life going that wasn't about writing, really. Has that helped make your teaching and your way of teaching really accessible? Because as a non-literary person, I read this book and I felt invited into the whole process. And that's something that I always notice about you when I hear you being interviewed, when I read your stuff. It's very accessible, even though it's about a lot of stuff that could be very sort of ethereal. Would you say that's something that you are able to bring to the table?
That question makes me really happy, Luke. Thank you. I totally agree with you. My thought is that, you know, art, in our time, somehow it's gotten this bad rap for being the thing that the nerds do. You know, the elitists go over there and, you know, perform this inscrutable dance, you know. And then afterwards, they talk about it with their berets on and all that. But really, you know, from the very beginning of time, art came about because we don't know what's going on down here, and we're mostly scared. So around the campfire, people said, and they probably told stories of their day, and then they figured out to tell metaphorical, exaggerated stories of things that they could imagine. And that was, it had a function. It served a purpose. It still does, you know. I mean, like during this pandemic, who hasn't been reminded that we don't really know what's going on and that we're not at all in control of our phenomenon? Everybody's been reminded of that. So I think art shouldn't be inaccessible to anybody. You know, even if it's difficult, part of a culture's job is to teach our young people how to decipher difficult but necessary texts. That's called being a human being, you know. But it's not this kind of like, you know, niche thing that we do to show off. It's essential. So I can say I've gone along that path myself in my life. So yes, I'm very, very sympathetic to anybody who is put off by contemporary art. And I'm very, very eager to say, come on, this tent is really fun. It's really fun in here. And it's going to answer all the questions that keep you up at night, or at least help you ask the questions that keep you up at night. I'm a big believer in making it easy, you know?
I mean, this idea that you put forward in this book of like the job of a writer is just to keep the interest of the reader from sentence to sentence, you know? Is there enough of interest for the reader in this sentence that they want to just go to the next sentence with you? I mean, that's about as basic as it gets, but I'd never thought of it in that way.
Yeah, and it's totally, you know, it's so workable if you think about it, because we do that all the time. You know, we go out to lunch with somebody, and if they start, you know, checking their phone too much, you're like, uh-oh, something's got to, I've got to do something here. And so it's basically a model.
Yeah, leave.
Yeah, leave. Or, you know, or spill water on them. There you go. Now you're talking. But I mean, the thing is, in that model, there's a lot of power, because you say whatever human moment you find yourself in, whether you're in a story, writing a story or reading one, or at dinner or at a wedding or whatever, it's kind of a simple process, which is first you notice the state of things, you know. Am I energetically engaged with this other person? Am I with her? And then if not, there are some resources that you have to engage her. Part of it is just noticing the quality of the disengagement, you know. Oh, I've been talking about myself for 6 hours. You know, maybe I should ask about her. So to me, that's a really hopeful, you know, kind of a hopeful thing, because it says that the whole point of literature and life is connection by way of mutual alertness, something like that, you know. And what I love about writing is that's very abstract. And if somebody said, hey, George, you know, try to have connection by being mutually alert, you're like, yeah, I'll try. But in writing, it gives you every day a line by line tutorial on that, you know. You write your sentence and you go, I wonder if my good friend who I haven't met yet, my reader, would still be with me, you know. And if not, then you go, why not? Which is often a kind of a mirror into into your particular form of not being alert, I guess.
You teach at this program at Syracuse that famously has a lot of applicants every year, and only a very small fraction of those applicants can be admitted to the program. I have to say, though, reading this book, I felt kind of like I was in the program. If I were to tell people that I studied under George Saunders,
yeah.
Now that I've read this book, would that be okay with you, George? And also, yeah. Could you not correct the record if someone says, oh, you taught Luke Burbank?
No, basically, just memorize two or three of my folksy aphorisms, and I'll send you a certificate, and then you're good.
Well, for the thousands of us who will never make our way into that MFA program, I'm going to say this is a pretty decent auditing of the course. The book is really incredible. A Swim in a Pond in the Rain by George Saunders. George, thank you so much for coming back on LiveWire.
I will do it anytime. You guys are so amazing. Thank you so much for what you do.
That was George Saunders right here on the LiveWire House Party. What a mensch. His latest book is, and I'm going to read the full title. It's kind of long, but A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a master class on writing, reading, and life. When you're George Saunders, you get to name your book whatever you want.
I think that's
the takeaway from that.
It's like a Fiona Apple album. Oh, I have to tell you before we move on that, you just heard what a wonderful man George Saunders is. And here at the grad program where I teach, where he does not teach, he had a huge fan in one of our students a couple years ago. And our students get one reading a year where they read for all their peers and members of the community downtown at this little coffee shop. and another student introduces the reader. And that student knew how much the reader loved George Saunders. And she just cold emailed George Saunders out in Syracuse and said, "Do you have a pep talk that I could give as my introduction for your biggest fan?" And George Saunders, he wrote a paragraph for this complete stranger student to read out loud in order to make another student's day on the day of her reading.
Oh.
Because that is how magical a menschy kind of guy George Saunders is.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That's like I'm trying to learn how to shoot free throws. Could somebody email Michael Jordan and ask him for some tips? Like, that's the person you want to have hyping you up when you're doing anything kind of literary. All right, we got to take a quick break here on the LiveWire House Party, but don't go anywhere, because when we get back, we're going to hear some music from Gillette Johnson that you definitely do not want to miss. So stay with us. It's the LiveWire House Party. LiveWire is thrilled to be partnering with Portland's own Portal Tea this season. Formerly known as Tea Chai Tay, Portal Tea is the premier tea company in the Pacific Northwest. They make one-of-a-kind, handcrafted tea blends like cinnamon churro chai and blueberry cream Earl Grey. Use the code LiveWire, all lowercase, for 20% off at portaltea.co. Welcome back to the LiveWire House Party. I'm your host, Luke Burbank, here with our announcer, Elena Passarello. We are talking about writing on the show this week, and our musical guest began writing her own songs at the age of 8. By her teens, she was playing her music all over New York City, and since then, she has turned down an offer to appear on The Voice, released 3 albums, including her latest, which is It's a Beautiful Day and I Love You. Let's welcome Gillette Johnson to the LiveWire House Party.
Thanks for having me.
You are whereabouts as we find you today?
I am in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah?
And I'm at my house. My cat is scratching at the door to my studio to try to get in. Mm-hmm. So that's what my environment looks like.
Well, what song are we going to hear? And what can you tell us about it?
So this song's called I Shouldn't Go Anywhere. And I wrote it before the pandemic, but then I put it out in July, and it made a different kind of sense than when I wrote it.
You also wrote a song called Mask Up back in 2014, which no one could have known how prescient that was.
Yeah.
I do see, by the way, you're selling masks on your merch site with the name of the album on there, which is very clever, actually.
Oh, thank you. Well, the album is called It's a Beautiful Day and I Love You. And I just feel like if you can't show people you're smiling, that's an okay thing to say.
I sort of interrupted you, though. Yeah. Can you tell us anything else about this song and sort of how it came about?
Yeah, I wrote it about feeling a little bit insecure and like a fish out of water. It's a self-deprecating song a bit, that the line I shouldn't go anywhere really is like me, you know, when you're at a party and you say something to someone that you don't know very well, and then you see their eyes kind of change, and then you feel really uncomfortable, and then you carry it with you for the rest of the night, and then you can't wait to get home. Anybody else?
Oh, yeah.
It intrusively revisits you for the next 10 to 20 years? Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you're among friends, Gillette.
All right, cool.
And we're excited to hear this. This is Gillette Johnson here on the LiveWire House Party.
No excuses, they are useless. Pointing blame is proven fruitless. It just gets me more upset. And it makes me feel pathetic with my glassy eyes. I think I can see inside, pierce the wall, find the gall, but it's just the alcohol talking to me. Am I really gonna cry right now, sitting at the bar? I shouldn't go there, I shouldn't go. It's my party and I want to do whatever I can to taunt you. I avoid and then destroy and then I've lost the only boy that I found round here all year who inspires that kind of fear with my stomach in a ball.
That was Gillette Johnson. Her latest album is It's a Beautiful Day and I Love You, which I just feel like it's always the right time for that message.
Yeah.
It's always the right time to hear that.
Yeah, amen.
That is going to do it for this episode of the LiveWire House Party. A huge thanks to our guests, Talib Kweli, George Saunders, and Gillette Johnson. LiveWire is brought to you in part by Alaska Airlines.
Laura Haddon is our executive producer. Heather D. Michelle is our executive director. Tim Harkins is our production director. Our producer and editor is Melanie Sevchenko, and Ariana Donneville is our marketing manager. Our music is composed by A. Walker Spring. Molly Pettit is our technical director, and she mixed this episode. Special thanks to our interns, Paige Thomas and Audrey Smith.
Additional funding provided by the Oregon Cultural Trust and the James F. and Marion L. Miller Foundation. LiveWire was created by Robin Tenenbaum and Kate Sokoloff. This week, we would like to thank member Shona Kester of Minneapolis, Minnesota. For more information about our show or how you can listen to our podcast, skedaddle on over to livewireradio.org. I'm Luke Burbank for Elena Passarello and the whole LiveWire crew. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Dear LiveWire, when we first met, I was really shy. I had no idea we'd spend so much time together or that you'd be one to fill my heart with joy and make me want to be a better person. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were here. I was busy reading a review from one of our many, many rapturously smitten listeners. Oh, wait, actually, no, sorry, this is from Elena. Anyway, the point is, it would be really helpful if you wanted to leave us a review
feel free to say really nice things about us, and we'll even read them now and then on the show. So you might hear your review of LiveWire read on the program itself. Reviews help other people hear about the show, and then we can keep doing this for a long, long time because we love having this job. Thank you so much. If you've left a review, and if you're about to leave a review, you can go ahead and do it right where you get the podcast.